Good morning. And, this is quite the welcome to Beth Tikva. I've never been here before, so I'm very happy and excited to be here this morning. I will try to be audible to everybody in the back. Greg Grover emailed me that he's stuck at the hospital, so hopefully all goes well there. But I guess that means I'll just start. First of all, I'm Mordechai Torjiner, for anyone who wasn't aware. I'm with the Yeshiva University Torah Mitzion Beit Midrash. We're based in a high school not that far from here, Yeshivat Or Chaim. And among our programs, we do programs for university students, programs for high school students, and then aside from that, I get myself in trouble around the community, trying to keep myself busy. Does everyone have the sheets?
No.
Okay, that's not great. I don't know where to get other ones here. So. Oh, they're making copies. Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you very much. So, given the size of the group, we'll see how things go in terms of getting to discuss and ask questions and the like. We'll do the best that we can with it, because this is planned as a 3-week series on Jewish superstition. This week we have the evil eye, next week we have the dibbuk, and then the third week I think is black magic. So there's a lot to talk about, that's for sure. I don't know if the office had people like register at all. I don't think so. Because usually what I like to do is I record audio from the classes and then I put it online. And so people, if they miss a week, can catch the recording. But I'm not sure how I would send you the link given that there's no registration. So, except that I can tell you that on the sheets, for those who have them, you see my email address at the top right under the title. And you can certainly email me for it. So, I'll begin with a classic story. Some of you may have heard this from me at some point before. The story on Mr. Schwartz, when he was called upon to testify in court. Ring a bell? No? Okay, good. Then it's new. Mr. Schwartz is called upon to testify in court. And he gets on the stand, and they ask him his name, and they ask him where he lives, and they ask him, how old are you? So he says, yeah, someone knows it already. He says, Kenayin Ahara, 74. The judge doesn't know what to make of it. And the judge says, Mr. Schwartz, how old are you? He says, Kenayin Ahara, 74. And he's getting frustrated. He asks him a third time, gets the same response, till finally the Jewish lawyer on the other side says, Your Honor, can I take care of this? He says, sure. He says, Mr. Schwartz, Kenayin Ahara, how old are you? 74. It's such a natural thing for us. It's such a natural thing for us. I suspect that many of us say Kenayin Ahara, which is a Yiddishism. It's an abbreviated form of what is in Hebrew Keneged Ayin Hara, but Ken in Yiddish being against an Ayin Hara, against an evil eye. But what exactly is this about? Where does this come from? Is this a Jewish thing in the first place? That's where I want to go with this. But I also want to talk about some of the practices which you may be familiar with within Judaism to avoid ayin hara, to avoid an evil eye. What practices do you know that are employed to avoid? Poo poo poo.
Redemption.
Spitting.
Redemption.
The red string. The red bendle.
Redemption of the coins.
Redemption of the firstborn. That's interesting, because that one is stated in the Torah before there's ever any idea of an ayin hara. So that one I wouldn't link. Diane. The hand, the chamsa. The chamsa. Who says that? Who in the world says that's Jewish? Yes. What is that? Oh, that's a new one to me. Biga or Feig, depending on which side you lived on in Europe. Okay. Yes, Marlene. Oh boy, that's a German one. Say it again. Can you translate that?
An incantation.
Yes.
To dispel the Torah.
Yes.
Only be by women.
Oh, that was the one you had showed me that a couple of years ago. Right, the incantation against Ayin Hara by women. Okay, yes.
A safety pill.
which is somewhere in your clothes.
Keeping a safety pin in your clothes. What did they do before safety pins? They just all suffered from the evil eye. Roseanne. Sorry? Stepping into a room with the right foot first. I think that's Pennsylvania Dutch. Yes. Shlun Kaparos. So that one is associated with other elements within Judaism. It's also a very interesting topic in its own right. I'm not sure I would link that one with the evil eye. Yeah?
You can't put your bed facing out the door.
Not making the bed face the door. This is amazing. I'm learning a whole bunch of other ways to be safe. Yes. Sylvia.
What about throwing salt over your shoulders?
Yes, yes.
Salt over your shoulder. Is that a Jewish one? I'm not so sure. Yes. Right, the poo-poo-poo one. That was actually number one on the board. That was the number one response so far. Okay, all sorts of ones. How about this one? Not calling up siblings to the Torah in sequence. Right? You've seen that? Not calling up siblings to the Torah in sequence, right? Where I come from, that's not calling up brothers, but brothers, sisters, and Torah. These are all practices which, if they're not originally related to Ayin Hara, at least to some people they have become that, right? People are saying them. There's a thought in people's heads. What in the world is this? I'm going to cut off the practices because we have to get to some of the sources on this. What is this? How did this become a Jewish thing? So it's very interesting. Take a look at the first source on your sheets, please. This is highly quoted from a professor named Alan Dundees. You see this quoted all over the place. On the origin of the evil eye, Dundees theorizes that the evil eye, which has a Middle Eastern, Mediterranean, and Indo-European distribution pattern, and was unknown in the Americas, Pacific Islands, Asia, Sub-Saharan Africa, or Australia until the introduction of European culture, right? All the things the Europeans brought, places they didn't want them. The evil eye is one of them. It's based upon underlying beliefs about water equating to life and dryness equating to death. He posits that the true evil done by the evil eye is that it causes living beings to dry up, notably babies, milking animals, young fruit trees, nursing mothers. The harm caused by overlooking consists of sudden vomiting or diarrhea in children, drying up of milk in nursing mothers or livestock, withering of fruit on orchard trees, and loss of potency in men. In short, the envious eye, quote, dries up liquids, according to Professor Alan Dundees, a fact that he contends demonstrates its Middle Eastern desert origins. That's a fascinating idea that doesn't fit anything I've ever heard in Judaism about the evil eye. But it's a fascinating idea. I mean, you understand what he's saying. He's pointing to the idea that this starts in our neck of the woods, so to speak. It starts around the Mediterranean. He notes that there are deserts in that area. And based on that, he makes the statement that it's associated with the drying up of liquids and that that's how it spreads within society because life depends on moisture. The truth of the matter is, you have deserts all around the world, right? I mean, 30 degrees latitude, right, plus or minus off of the equator because of the Hadley cells phenomenon. Those aren't meteorologists. The bottom line is the airflow is going to cause there to be deserts in a band around the globe at certain latitudes. It's not the property of the Mediterranean. It's an interesting idea. But no, I don't think that's where ours came from. I think it's an interesting idea, but I don't think it's where we came from. Where does it come from in Judaism? What would be the Jewish source? How early can you go within Judaism to find an evil eye? Sorry? In days of Egypt? What do you mean? Potentially back in the days of the pharaohs, but you wouldn't find a text necessarily to support it. Okay. Yeah. Cain and Abel. Oh boy, where do we see an evil eye there? What was the evil in his? Sorry? Jealous, and he winds up killing his brother. So that's really interesting. That's really interesting, because now we're talking. We've now transitioned from the idea of an open-ended superstition. Greetings. We've transitioned from the idea of an open-ended superstition, which could be associated with the pharaohs for all we know, and Jewish life in Egypt, to something very specific, and a natural human trait called jealousy. How does that transition to become evil eye? If this is really about jealousy and about the way human beings relate to each other, how does that become known as something for which you say, poo, poo, poo? Where does that fit? How does that transition into a red string? Right? Or any of the other practices, throwing salt over your shoulder and the incantation by women, where does that go? So I'm gonna take us back to biblical text. And to the very first reference we find to an evil eye. Take a look, please, at source number 2. This is within the story of Ishmael. Right? Remember that Abraham is married to Sarah. They are not able to have children. Sarah says to Abraham, I want you to marry my maid. She should become your wife. That's Hagar. Abraham marries Hagar. Hagar becomes pregnant. There's a first go-round between Hagar and Sarah because Hagar is lording it over Sarah. Look, I was able to become pregnant. There must be something wrong with you. Sarah kicks her out of the house. Well, actually, no, sorry. Sarah makes her life miserable. She runs away, right? Then an angel tells her, go back. She comes back. She has a son. His name is Ishmael. And then Ishmael is 13 years old. At that point, Abraham is told by God, have a brit milah, a circumcision. And a year later, Isaac is born. So Ishmael is now 14 years old. Not so happy with the birth of his half-brother. His half-brother is born and immediately is, of course, king of the roost. Because his half-brother is the son of Abraham and Sarah, the one who was promised and foretold. And there is some jealousy going on there. And Sarah sees that as Isaac, the newborn, grows, there's a threat from Ishmael. How to understand that threat is a great discussion for another time. Was it a physical threat? Was it that Ishmael questioned the legitimacy of his younger brother, as some commentators suggest? Good question. But fundamentally, there's a threat that Sarah perceives. And she says to Abraham, you see that one over there, Ishmael? He's now 17 years old, because his brother has already been weaned. He's 17. Time to get him out of the house. He's a threat to his half-brother. Kick him out. Kick out his mother. I don't want to see them in the house. And here you get source number 2, from Genesis, from Bereshit. And the matter was very evil in Abraham's eyes. That is the first biblical association of evil with eyes. In the Hebrew, vayera, from the word ra, be'enei Avraham. It was ra in the eye of Avraham. It was evil in the eye of Abraham. Now that doesn't quite sound yet like the phrase ayin hara. That's not quite the same thing, but that's our starting point, where it becomes more like what we are familiar with. More like ayin hara is in source number 3, the other end of the Chumash of the Bible. And this is the book of Deuteronomy. There's a mitzvah called Shemitah. What is the mitzvah of Shemitah about? Seventh year. Leaving the land fallow every seventh year. The land in Israel has to lay fallow. And what else? No, slaves are every 50. There's a six-year cycle, but it isn't the sabbatical cycle. Sorry? The slaves are freed after their 6 years, not in the sabbatical year. Debts, correct. Releasing debts. Forgiving debts. The rule is that at the end of the seventh year, if somebody owes me money and has not yet paid up, owes me money meaning that the debt could actually actually have been claimed. I could have claimed the debt already, and he hasn't paid up. At that point, I forgive the debt. That's the rule. The sabbatical year causes the release of debts. Now you'll say, that's a very difficult way to run a society. Right? Because what's going to happen if you do that? Sorry? Right. Either the borrowers are going to wait it out, or the creditors are going to stop lending. Right? The borrower has an incentive to pay back, which is otherwise that's the last loan he's ever getting. Right? Realistically, if you wait it out, and everybody knows you could have paid, but you chose not to. You could have worked, but you chose not to. No one's going to lend to you again. So the borrower is likely to make a best effort. But the lender's going to say, forget it. As I, you know, right now, we're in the third, fourth year of the sabbatical year cycle. Right now, I'm willing to extend loans. I figure things will work out. But as I get closer to the seventh year, there's no way I want to lend somebody money unless he's going to let me set the collection date for after the end of the sabbatical year. Because if it's not collectible yet, then the sabbatical year doesn't cancel the debt. But that's neither here nor there. Look at this warning in number 3. Be careful lest there be an evil thought in your hearts. God addresses the creditor, the lender, saying, the seventh year nears, the year of release. You say, well, I don't want to lend. Your eye will be evil. Vira'a'incha. Your eye will be evil against your brother, the needy person, and you will not give him. The entire biblical economy rests on credit. Frankly, we learned about 15 years ago that so does ours, right? When the worldwide bank crisis. But it all rests on credit. And in the event that there's a refusal to lend, then everything comes to a halt. And so there's a biblical commandment. Don't have an evil eye towards others. And here we start to see more of what an evil eye is about. It's not just the disapproval with Abraham. It's the sense of, I don't want to provide for somebody else. And it gets even stronger further in Deuteronomy in source number 4. This is a prediction of a time of punishment coming that's going to befall the Jews if they sin. It's called in Hebrew the Tochacha. It's a message of punishment for the Jews. And we're told in here, the soft and very pampered among you will have an evil eye against his brother, refusing to give them, refusing to share with them the food that they will have. This is our basis for the concept of evil eye. I gave you another example in number 5, much later biblically in the book of Mishle, of Proverbs. Do not eat the bread of one whose eye is evil. Meaning, if you know someone doesn't want to share with you, don't eat at his table. Right? You're just asking for trouble. But the ways in which we look at this are not something mystical. It's not something that is supernatural. It's simply about the attitude of one person to another. It's somebody who looks at somebody else and says, I don't wish to share. And that's something that plays out in rabbinic writings about the evil eye. You don't see the red string show up. You don't see all these fun superstitions show up. We're going to get to them because they're there. So we need to talk about where they come from. But the early way it shows up is much closer to what you're seeing in the biblical text here, that it's about jealousy and about selfishness, as we'll see play out. Yes?
So, in essence, what you're saying, though, is that with the evil eye, when you look at these lenders who put on, like, loan sharks and all this, and they all have evil eye because some of their interest rates are exorbitant, they'll take your house, your life, whatever. So, most of the world has an evil eye because of, let's say, they put on ridiculous interest rates. Is that correct?
So, I'm not sure. It depends on how you look at it, I suppose. The question that was asked was whether, then, loan sharks and people who impose high interest have an evil eye. So, I'm not sure I look at it that way, because the evil eye description is the one who refuses to help somebody else. He's very willing to help you as a means of helping himself. Ultimately, he's trying to enrich himself as opposed to help somebody. I suppose the answer would be, if he refuses to lend at a normal rate, then yes. keeping in mind that we have our own laws within Judaism about lending for interest altogether, which is its own discussion. Take a look at your sheet, please, at number 6. Fascinating lesson from Pirkei Avot. Pirkei Avot, part of the Mishnah, canonized in the 3rd century Common Era. Pirkei Avot is usually translated as what? Ethics of the Fathers. That's likely not what it means. A perek, if you go back to Talmudic Hebrew, is a lesson. That's specifically what a perek is. It's a lesson. And an av, while it can mean father, more often in Talmudic Hebrew is first or source. So, for example, we talk about the 39 categories of tasks that are not to be done on Shabbat, and those are called in Hebrew what? Avot Melacha. The 4 central categories of tort law in Judaism are Avot Nizikin. The central categories of ritual impurity are Avot Hatumah. An Av is a central or source or first that leads to others. So Pirkei Avot, really, could be translated as central lessons or source lessons from which we are meant to learn the ideas of the Torah. So take a look at what you have here in number 6. That's why I left it as Pirkei Avot in my title. Rabbi Yehoshua taught, he said, evil eye, evil desire, and hatred of others remove a person from this world. Evil eye. What is evil eye that removes a person from this world? I mean, the person who has the evil eye, not the person who casts an evil eye on somebody else. The person who personally displays an evil eye. That's going to get him out of this world. Says Maimonides in his commentary in number 6, desire for wealth. Desire for wealth. A person who is greedy. A person who says, I want, that's the evil eye. Take a look at number 7. Also from Pirkei Avot. One who has an evil eye, a haughty spirit, and a broad soul, I translated for you there, it means complacent really, is of the students of wicked Bilam. Who is Bilam? False. He wasn't a false prophet, he's a real prophet, right?
He was sent to prophesy against them.
He was sent to prophesy against the Jews. He was sent to curse the Jews. Right? If you remember the biblical account, after the Jews have gone through their 40 years in the wilderness, they are now about to enter the land of Israel. There's a nation called Moab that lives on the eastern side of the Jordan, and they are scared that we are coming through. What did they think was going to happen? Sorry? What did Moab think was going to happen?
Take away
their produce and their land. So I would split the difference. They're afraid we're going to take their produce. They're not afraid we're going to take their land. Remember, we've been promised the land of Canaan. That's the other side of the Jordan. Not to mention, I don't know whether they know it, but the Jews are commanded explicitly, don't go to war against Moab, because Moab are our first cousins. Moab was descended from Lot, who was the brother of Sarah. Right? So he's Abraham's brother-in-law, and you know how things go sometimes with brothers. That's where they come from. So we're told, don't go to war against Moab. And what the biblical text says, and this is really important to understand this line, what the biblical text says is that Moab is not afraid we're going to go to war with them. They said, Yelachachu ha-kahal et kol sivivotenu kilecho hashor eit yerek hasadeh. What they said was, this nation that's coming through, they're going to lick up all of the land around us like an ox licking up all the grass that's growing in the field. What they worry about are resources. They see these Jews coming and they say, not in my backyard. That's what they're afraid of. They don't want to share. That's Moab's problem. And when you think about it, you realize that's not just their problem then. That's always been Moab's problem. When was Moab born? Anybody know? Sorry? Yeah? Right, after Sodom. Who is the? What's the story there? Yeah? The two daughters. Thank you. The two daughters. Is that what you're going to say?
No, it's because the whole split starts when they can't share the field.
Exactly. Very good. The whole story of Moab begins when Lot and Abraham split. Because there isn't enough land for all of the sheep. And Abraham says there are fights going on between the shepherds, right? Midrash adds, by seeing certain elements in the verses, that actually what's going on is that Lot is letting his animals invade the fields of others. Abraham says to Lot, listen, yeah, this isn't working out. So you take whatever you want and I'll go the opposite direction. Take whatever you want. And Lot looks around and he says, okay, that looks good. And when we say that, the biblical text says, he looks at Kol Kikar HaYarden, the entire shore of the Jordan River. Yeah, that looks good. You can have whatever else you want. Go off into the, you know, the wilderness in Judea. You can have the mountains. I'm taking the shore of the Jordan. He has big eyes, this fellow Lot. Well, he does. And he ends up moving to a city called Sodom. We know what Sodom's reputation is. Sodom is a city that doesn't know how to share. They're very happy for everybody to have what they own. They don't start wars with others. But don't you dare come into Sodom looking for a handout. Don't ever look for a place to stay in the city of Sodom. They tell the story. This is totally apocryphal and probably not true, but it's a great story anyway. Regarding the Vilna Gaon, the end of the 18th century, Vilna Gaon, leading scholar in Lithuania, was always sought after for his advice for the community. Whenever questions came up in Vilna, they wanted his advice. And they would take him to these town council, and he said, you know, I don't want to go to your councils. Okay, I have things to do. If there's something new that comes up, Then I'll attend. So at one point they have a big problem. The problem is Mishulachim. There are people who are coming to the city looking for help, and they're going door to door, and they're collecting, and it's all of this tzedakah money is leaving the community, and so the people are very agitated and upset, and they decide we're going to make a rule, and the rule is all of our tzedakah will be local. We're not going to help those from outside the community. And this is a new idea. So they call for the Vilna Gaon, and they say to him, you know, would you please come to our meeting? We have a new idea and a new initiative to discuss. So he says, okay. He comes to the meeting, and they tell him what they're thinking of. And they say, what do you think? He said, didn't I tell you to only call me to the meeting if you have something new to discuss? And they said, well, this is new. He said, no, it's not. Look in Bereishit. It's a story of Sodom. They also didn't want to help people from the outside. They also wanted all their money to stay local. So that's the story of the people of Sodom. That's the sin of Sodom, is that they don't wish to help. And we get the story with the angels who come to visit Lot, and they're attacked and so forth. But the point is, Lot escapes the city in the merit of Abraham and Sarah. Right? Lot gets out of the city with his two daughters. And then they run off into the hills. And they see the city and the whole region demolished. And the daughters say, well, you know, there's nobody else around, so I guess it's just Lot. And as terrible as this is, that's what happens. Both the older and the younger daughter end up getting their father drunk, and that's a story in its own right, not for right now. But they end up having children from their father. One of them is Ammon, also its own story, and the other is Moab. Moab, literally, Me'ab, from dad. Because that's totally the name you give your kid. Sorry, it's true. The point is that this is who you're talking about. This is the nation which cannot share. Its roots go back to Lot, demanding all that land for himself. The city of Sodom, which cannot share. That's what this is. And then they see the Jews coming and they say, well, we want nothing to do with them. They're going to eat up all our resources. And so what do? They hire Bilaam. And Bilaam's job is to curse the Jews. And what the Mishnah here, the lesson here in Pirkei Avot says, is that this evil eye, that's of the students of wicked Bilaam. The opposition is between Bilaam and Abraham. Abraham is the one who is generous. He always opens up his tent and he welcomes people in. And Bilaam is the one who can't share, representing Moab in this regard. That's what we're talking about. We're talking about selfishness overall. Now, in and of itself, if you just stopped with the sources that we had, I wouldn't understand why there's anything supernatural involved at all. It's simply a matter of evil eye. It means I am jealous of somebody else, I'm not. but for the sake of the story, I am jealous of somebody else, and and I might act against them or refuse to help them. But it's not that simple. And the reason why it's not that simple is because of what comes next. Take a look, please, at source number 8. This is a passage out of the Talmud, which talks about what's called in Hebrew Moser Din al Chaveiro, somebody who passes judgments to God about somebody else. And the Talmud says, one who passes judgment to God regarding another person, a person who turns to God and says, that person does terrible things, that person does not deserve what they have, you do that, you'll be punished first. A person who turns to God and says, hey, they don't deserve what they have, is going to suffer first. But what's the implication of that line? What's the implication? For sure you shouldn't do it, but what's the implication by saying that person will be punished first? Someone said, yeah, that implies there's a second. The person who says, the person who comes to the synagogue and turns to God and says, why do they get what they get? Me, I didn't get it, but you let this person have it? Why do they have their good fortune? Why are their kids so good? And so on and so forth. There's a sense here that even though the person who does it is going to be punished, nonetheless, the other person could actually really suffer bad results. The other person could really suffer bad results. It isn't only about the person who did it. Take a look at source number 9. Okay. It's okay. Take a look at source number 9. Also a passage in the Talmud. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel taught, wherever scholars have turned their eyes, death or poverty has ensued. Suggesting that there is a possibility that an individual might have somehow, for some reason, because of their own personal merit in this case, the ability to turn to God and to say, this person doesn't deserve what they have. That's the fear here. And that introduces a whole other level to what we're talking about. It's no longer mundane. It's no longer just one person's action against another, because now God got involved. And that's a very scary thing. Because how in the world can you protect yourself against that? What do you do? Yeah?
What's even worse is the scholars who are doing this. Sounds like they're the ones invoking God or whatever.
It does sound like that. It sounds very much like that. It sounds like the scholar is going to be the one to do it. And we're a little surprised, because why would a scholar do that? But I think we know the answer to that, right? Go back to source number 2. Why does Abraham have this evil eye, so to speak, regarding the decision to evict Ishmael? He loves his son because he thinks this is wrong. He's outraged. It's unfair, it's inappropriate. I don't know about unfair. I mean, he's 17 years old, you know, let him go out and get a job. This is true, and he has to work on his resume. I get it. Maybe give him a couple of days, some bread and water to take with him. So the idea here is not necessarily that the scholar is going to be personally jealous, but the scholar says, wait a minute, where is the justice in this world? We know stories like this, biblical stories like this. What biblical story involves somebody who is angry that God is going to give people another chance?
Jonah.
Thank you. The story of Jonah. Jonah has, so to speak, an evil eye regarding the city of Nineveh. He says, God, why is it that you're going to give them another opportunity? Now, Jonah also is working with inside information. Because Jonah also knows that if the city of Nineveh survives, the capital of the Assyrian Empire, their next move is to invade and destroy Israel, the northern kingdom. right? So he knows what he's enabling by helping the city of Nineveh to repent. But Jonah's fundamental objection, as it's expressed in the text in the beginning of the fourth chapter in the book of Jonah, is, God, I knew you were going to be merciful to them, and I don't like it. I don't think that they deserve it. That's what we're talking about here. The scholar who turns to them and says, they don't deserve it. Right? Another example. Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai. Some of you were in my class at Adath Israel when I talked about this sometime before Lag BaOmer. So it's about a month ago. We talked about it then. Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai and his son are on the run from the Romans. They live in a cave for a dozen years. All they have are what? What do they subsist on? Carobs and water. That's it. Carobs and water is their survival mechanism. They live the study of Torah for 12 years. Then they find out that the government is no longer after them. And they leave the cave. And wherever they look, things burst into flame. What that means is a really good question. But my point isn't the fire piece of it, Paul, fire department. My point is, they're outraged. They don't understand how it is that people could be engaged in mundane activities. They spent 12 years in pure devotion to God. How could people be plowing their fields? God will send them carobs. Let them sit and study. Right? Doesn't everyone want to live on carobs? Carobs, for those who don't remember it from your Tu B'Shvat in elementary school, right? You can't chew them. I don't know what state their teeth were in after 12 years. That's Buxer. That's what it is. So, but that's the issue here. The evil eye transcends being one person's conduct towards another and becomes something else. It becomes a spiritual call to God to harm them, which comes very close to really being what we think of as a curse, fundamentally. So we get these concerns then for evil eye. And along with that, we get defenses against the evil eye. I don't want to be hit by the evil eye. What am I able to do to prevent that from happening? Well, some classic commentators and authorities in Jewish law said, we don't want you messing with defenses against the evil eye. This is weird. And when we say weird in Judaism, that's usually followed by prohibited. If you take a look at source number 10, Maimonides, in his Guide of the Perplexed, he says, he's talking about strategies like this to take advantage of the supernatural. He said, these lies created by early fools were recorded, and the books were brought to good people of soft spirit, fools who lacked a scale with which to know truth from falsehood. They hid these books which were found in their estates, and people thought them to be true. Right? They stored these things away. In the end, the fool will believe everything, writes Maimonides. He says, people are making this stuff up about using divine names to carry out supernatural deeds. We're going to talk about this more when we get to magic in the third week. But Maimonides believes that all of this stuff is foolishness. You ask Maimonides what to do? His answer will be Torah and mitzvot. That's what you do. None of these chamsa things and whatnot. There was a hand back there. Yeah. Yeah.
Wait. But isn't the first line of defense against the evil eye seeks the fact the individual knows that potentially their evil eye is judgment, but potentially their conduct is incorrect? Mm-hmm. What should the first line of defense against the evil eye be changing conduct? For your first example with respect to sharing, the first line, you think that perhaps you will in fact of the subject.
Correct. So Nanette makes an important point, which is that if you're really concerned about this, then maybe the answer is a more natural defense. If you don't want people to be jealous of you, then maybe the approach is to share with them. We're going to talk more about that. I'm not quite there yet, but that is going to come up. But one approach has been to say, all of these strategies, leave aside the sharing strategy, but all these strategies in general are superstition. That's essentially what Maimonides is suggesting. Frankly, some of these strategies came to us from other cultures. For example, quite possibly, the red string. Take a look, please, at source number 11. This is from a passage in the Tosefta. We mentioned earlier the Mishnah. The Mishnah is the earliest canonized text of Jewish law, a recording of our verbal tradition canonized in the 3rd century Common Era. However, when you canonize a text, you leave some things out. And some of the text that was omitted was then canonized into a separate text called Tosefta, meaning that which is added. Lahosif. It's an addendum, essentially. Some of it was omitted from the Mishnah because it was of questionable authenticity. Some of it because it was believed to be redundant. Some of it because the canonizers of the Mishnah didn't even have access to a complete text. So when you see something in the Tosefta, you're not always sure of the proper edition and its legal standing. But take a look at source number 11. They're dealing with the question of what one is allowed to carry with oneself when traveling on Shabbat outside of an Eruv. And here they mention one who ties a red string. If a person has a red string tied onto themselves. This is a really old text, far older than the people who are selling them at the wall, right? Or at the grave of Rachel, right? So Rabban Gamliel says, this is not an Amorite practice. The Amorites were one of the chief clans of Canaanites the Jews encountered when they entered the land of Israel. They were considered to be heavily idolatrous in terms of their practices. When you want to say something is a pagan practice associated with idolatry, you call it in Hebrew, Darkei Amori, Amorite practices. You tie a red string, Rabban Gamliel says, that's okay. That's not an Amorite practice. Rabbi Elazar, son of Rabbi Tzadok, says, you bet it is. He says, of course this is an Amorite practice. This is not one of ours at all. Now, that's not... Sorry. Who wins? Well, take a look at number 12. Maimonides always wins. He writes, the practices of the nations, which they considered forces and sigulot, special practices, even practices which lack a sense of idolatry, are prohibited. The Torah prohibited all of their practices, which are titled Amorite practices, which came to them from idolatry. He doesn't actually enumerate the red string. But he has a blanket rule. If someone tells you to do something, and there's no rational explanation for why it should work, and it's not tied into a scriptural source or a mitzvah, he says, forget it. It's superstition. Don't go that way. He's an uber-rationalist. I mean, you have to know that when you're dealing with Maimonides. But that's his take. He doesn't like it. Now, there are those who argue the red string could be connected because Rachav, who saved the two spies when they came to Jericho, hung a string outside her window. Maybe. But this source here didn't seem to think so, and they were familiar with the story of Rachav. Even if you take the view that says it's not an Amorite practice, he's not saying, and this is a Jewish one. He's just saying the Amorite didn't do this either. So there is a trend of suspicion towards defenses against the evil eye. Having said that, if you think you can eviscerate... eviscerate is probably too strong a word. If you think you can expunge Jewish tradition of these various concerns for the evil eye, you're fooling yourself. It's just not true. There's a concept in Jewish law called hezek ri'iyah. Hezek is damage, harm. Ri'iyah is sight, lirot. Damage caused by seeing something. And there is a rule that says I am not allowed to look into somebody else's property. Somebody else's yard, the window of somebody else's home. A Jew is not allowed to look into somebody else's property. Obviously they invite you in, that's a different story. But otherwise it is prohibited. There are very serious zoning laws in Jewish law about building property that will overlook someone else's yard or prevent them from using their house in the way that they wish. And there are various explanations for this. On a very basic level, it's a privacy issue. But take a look at source number 13, Nachmanides, 13th century. Regarding damage one causes to property by sight, he says this refers to vandalism via evil eye, harmful speech or violation of privacy? Going in reverse here. Violation of privacy because you're looking into his property and now he can't use the property the way he wants to. Harmful speech because whatever you see there is now being told first to you and then to others who you speak to, you're going to be talking about and reporting what you see within their property. But the first item is evil eye. By looking into his property, you're going to become jealous of what he has. You're going to appeal to God. That in and of itself is a type of harm. Source number 14, I mentioned it earlier. Rabbi Yosef Karo in the Shulchan Aruch, in the Code of Jewish Law, one may call two brothers or a father and son consecutively. Technically speaking, he says there's nothing wrong with calling the two family members one after the other. But we don't permit it due to the evil eye. And you know something? I was at a wedding, it's about 15 years ago now, maybe 12 years ago, where I saw this. And it really struck me. Not this case. I was at a wedding, and between the bride and the groom, they had seven brothers. And so for the Sheva Brachot, they called up one by one each of the brothers to say one of the Brachot. And on the one hand, that was beautiful. You know, a family all united together, and they were able to do it, and it was really nice. And on the other end, I'm sitting there thinking to myself, what about the people who can't have kids, right? And who are now upset and jealous. And you know, I mean, certainly the family never intended to hurt anybody's feelings. They're the sweetest, nicest people. But you wonder about inspiring that type of jealousy in somebody. It's the same idea with not calling up the family members in sequence. It can really antagonize people. Take a look at number 15. Number 15 is perhaps the best source on the red string. Rabbi Moshe Stern, the Debreziner Rebbe. And when you hear that he's the Debreziner, you already know which side he's going to be on regarding the red string. Staunch Hungarian. He's asked the question, is there a source for tying a red string on a child, carriage, and so on because of the evil eye? Is this one of ours? Answer. That was the universal practice in Hungary. That was the universal practice. Is there anything outside of Hungary? They were careful to tie a red string on a carriage and a crib of a child because of the evil eye. All of these are the practices of elderly women. But he's not saying that in a negative way. Look, regarding which Rabbi Shlomo Ibn Aderet wrote that we should not mock their words and practices, for they are certainly founded in the sacred mountains, even if we do not know the reasons. He says, there's got to be a source if they're doing it. Rabbi Shlomo Ibn Aderet, also known as Rashba, was a leading authority in Jewish law from the 14th century, who is not talking about the red string here. But he's saying that if your grandmother did it, don't veer from it. She knows what she's doing, and you may not understand why. Right, and that's exactly the problem. What if this really is? There are customs that are foolish, and they arise for all sorts of funny reasons. So, I mean, you all know the stories. You don't need me to stand here and tell you stories. At the same time, we have a record of respect for things that we don't understand and that we don't perceive. We don't necessarily assume that they are powerless. These things have sticking power. And I think the reason why they have sticking power within Judaism is because we recognize the authentic root. Meaning, we recognize that jealousy is an issue. It's a human trait. And we recognize further that prayer is powerful. We recognize that. Somebody can pray to God, hopefully for a positive purpose, and within Judaism, that's going to have real significance. The leap is that I can do something about that with my red string. Right? So I understand that someone might be jealous of me. I understand that they might be antagonized by my display of good fortune. But how is my red string going to prevent that from happening? Where did that come into play? Or my chamso, or my figi, figa? Fike, thank you. Where does that come in? Hang on. So the answer seems to be fear is what keeps that going. But what we have are other ways to benefit. Not necessarily what we just talked about in terms of all of these methods, but take a look at source number 16. One, is simply not to benefit from others. Don't take from others. Talmud says, an eye that does not desire, bless you, to benefit from others' property cannot be affected by an evil eye. If you don't take from other people, then no one's going to have an evil eye against you. They look at the person, they say, this person works hard, they got what they got honestly, they didn't take from me, they didn't take from anybody else. That affords a degree of protection on a very rational level. That's one. Second, not attracting attention, right? This is where the Kanayina Hara comes in, right? This is what we're talking about. People who don't want to say how many children they have. People who don't want to say how old they are. Or they'll preface their response, like Mr. Schwartz in the beginning of the class, right? They'll preface their response by saying, I don't want an Ayin Hara. I don't want anybody to be jealous. So number 17. This is an esoteric law. The issue is this. Somebody converts to Judaism, and in the case in number 17, does not get married. So they have a certain amount of property. They pass away. Who's the heir? Within Jewish law, there is no heir. So what happens? First come, first serve. Somebody walks in and takes ownership of the property. It's theirs. I'm leaving aside, obviously, the whole secular legal system and estate law and the taxes they're going to have to pay to the CRA. That's its own discussion. But the point is that in the Talmudic vision of what happens, somebody could walk in and get it for free. Well, if I find out that somebody just got something for free, what's my reaction? Jealousy. Why not me? Why not me? Actually, no, I would like a donation. No, the number 17. What should one do upon acquiring the property of a deceased convert? If somebody acquires something for nothing, what can they do to protect themselves? He should use it to acquire a Torah. Use it for a mitzvah. Rav Sheshet added, the same for a husband who inherits from his wife. Right? He may argue I did something, right? I took care of her, I was married to her for all those years, or whatever it is, but the statement here is, he didn't earn that, it came into the marriage from her side, so also, he should use it for some mitzvah. Rava added, and even one who receives great profit from a business investment, if you get an outsized profit from your investments, avoid jealousy, use it for a mitzvah. And Rav Papa added, even one who finds something, you find something as you're walking on the street, use it for a positive purpose. You don't want the jealousy of others. There are numerous elements like this. There's a passage in the Talmud, which I didn't bring here, which I really should have, which talks about investing and making sure you don't invest in a property which is going to be very large, which is very visible to people. You want to make your money off of something that is small that you can hide away from the eye, right? The Jews were in the diamond business in the in Europe. That's an example of it. Wanting not to invest in something that's going to be visible to others. And then you get to what Nanette mentioned before, which is the issue of sharing your bounty with others. You know, the law of the city of refuge, the Ir Miklat, right? The city of refuge is a place where an accidental murderer flees for safety. The accidental murderer is there for two reasons. On the one hand, for safety, and on the other hand, for a period of rehabilitation. Because even if what they did was accidental, nonetheless, it demonstrates a level of carelessness. When do they get to leave the city of refuge? When the Kohen Gadol passes away, when the high priest passes away, that's the end of their term. Why is that is a really good question, but we have like 4 minutes left. But point is this. The Talmud records the practice of the mother of the high priest. The mother of the high priest would furnish the needs of people who are in the city of refuge, lest they pray for her son to die so that they could get out of the city. That's what Annette was talking about. It's talking about trying to provide for others, and in that way you dispel their feelings of hostility, their feelings of jealousy. That's what we're trying to, that's what you're trying to do in a real Kanayina Hara, an act against jealousy. To sum up what we've said, we go back to the biblical text. We have the idea of an evil eye in the sense of looking negatively at something, in the sense of not wanting to share with somebody else, in the sense of jealousy for what somebody else has. And in that sense, you could trace it back to Cain. It's just that he doesn't use the phrase there of an evil eye. That's what's missing. But you find it moving forward into the period of the Talmud is a very rational idea. Jealousy, selfishness, and the idea as well that the person who is jealous may turn to God and yield some kind of punishment. That's where it gets into the supernatural realm. So people want to protect themselves from that. And sometimes they'll look at practices which aren't even ours. Right? Like the allegation regarding the red string, that it didn't come from us. They'll look at some kind of foolishness and say, well, this is what's going to protect me. And in fact, within Jewish law, we have concern for the evil eye, but the advice that we're given by Jewish tradition is not the red bendel, although Rabbi Stern says, you know, honor it, because it's our tradition. So, look, he's greater than I am, so, you know, go ahead. But on a very practical and rational level, it's making sure that we don't take advantage of others. It's making sure that we don't attract attention to what we have. And it's making sure that we aid others, that we be people of generosity, rather than people are going to inspire the jealousy of others. I look forward to continuing in weeks 2 and 3 with a Dybbuk and with magic. I'm going to stick around for a few minutes for questions. Hang on. Shh. Just a second, sorry. I'm going to stick around for questions for a few seconds, or a few minutes. My email address is on the sheet. For anyone who wants to email me afterwards for follow-up, I'll be glad to. And Rabbi Grover has my email address as well. Thank you so much.